At the counseling center, where I worked in Manhattan for a number of years as a psychotherapist, I had a minor specialization in an obscure item in the diagnostic manual known by its V code as a religious or spiritual problem. Clients whose religious or spiritual upbringing or involvement interfered with their emotional, mental, or spiritual well-being came to me for help, and I was glad to provide however much of it I could. One of my dearest clients had what I called double trouble. She had been raised in a strict household in a religiously repressive tradition, constrained by moral absolutes, radical intolerance, and punishing parenting. In an attempt to escape it, she found her way into another faith community that she later came to recognize as a cult, which she exited with remarkable courage and clarity. We'll call my client Sandy, which is not her name. These choices cost Sandy a great deal personally, but proved worth it in the end, given the spiritual and emotional freedom she won for herself. Because she was someone who was built for devotion, Sandy dedicated herself to the therapeutic process and never missed a session. The first December we worked together, she brought me a small gift for the holidays, a Christmas ornament, which before I had even finished unwrapping it, she announced was broken. I soon saw how. Oddly, Sandy had bought it that way at one of the craft fairs in a nearby park. She told me that because of that, she'd gotten a good discount. Not only was the ornament broken, but the box it came in was too. Inside the warped box with the lid that did not quite fit was an angel whose halo had snapped off and whose string had come loose. Sandy told me that she loved that angel at first sight. I did too, with an intensity and immediacy that surprised me. More than a decade later, I have the broken angel sitting in a place of pride on my shelves, testifying to the bold wisdom of imperfection. In his book, The Road to Tolerance, The Philosophy of Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, psychologist Albert Ellis sums up the insights he gleaned from decades of practicing the therapeutic method dubbed REBT. While he spent most of his early years railing against the errors of spirituality and religion and touting the benefits of psychology and philosophy, near to the end of his life and career, he came to recognize the considerable overlap among these domains. All of these influence mightily what we believe to be true about ourselves, about one another, and about the world we share. The rational and emotive were mutually informing, he explained, or should be. The problem for the unhappiest among us, he explained, were core beliefs that were deeply irrational. Once we recognize that, we could correct for some of their distorting effects. We are, and admit we are, very fallible, Dr. Ellis contended, as humans, not being gods, should be. By admitting this, we make ourselves stronger. These days, we all need to be a bit stronger, don't we? The first time I encountered an outline of Dr. Ellis's work, I was not in a clinical setting, but a support group. There, they distributed handouts cataloging people's most common irrational beliefs. Each handout counted off a dozen of these ideas, including one that it is a dire necessity for an adult human to be loved or approved by virtually every significant person in his or her community. Two, that one should be thoroughly competent, adequate, and achieving in all possible respects if one is to consider oneself worthwhile. Three, that certain people are bad, wicked, or villainous, and they should be severely blamed and punished for their villainy. Four, that it is awful and catastrophic when things are not the way one would very much like them to be. Five, that human unhappiness is externally caused and that people have little or no ability to control their disturbances. Six, that if something is dangerous or fearsome, one should be terribly concerned about it and should keep dwelling on the possibility of its occurring. 7, that it is easier to avoid than face certain life difficulties. 8, that one needs someone stronger than oneself on whom to rely. 9, that because something once strongly affected one's life, it should indefinitely have a similar effect. 10, that one should become quite upset over other people's problems and disturbances. 11, that there is invariably a right, precise, and perfect solution to human problems, and that it is catastrophic if this perfect solution is not found. And finally, 12, that you can give people a global rating. Their general worth depends upon the goodness of their performances. When I first finished reading this list, I was confounded. If these ideas were so irrational, then how did they become the guidelines that I and nearly everybody I knew used to get through life? Where I came from, worthiness and goodness were synonymous. An imprecise solution was pretty catastrophic. And the dangerous and fearsome were endlessly preoccupying for us. When Dr. Ellis distilled these 12 irrational ideas further, he recognized the patterns that he termed the major musts. The major musts tell people that things must be perfect if we are to be spared unending misery in our lives. These major musts are not only lies, they are recipes for interpersonal disaster. Honestly, who or what do you know in your own life to be perfect? How long can they remain that way? Why is that even an expectation that any of us harbors? According to Dr. Ellis, our best hopes for happiness involve us surrendering irrational ideas and major musts and adopting a more philosophical outlook centered on acceptance. This asks us to embrace 3 increasingly tolerant attitudes. First, unconditional acceptance of ourselves as we are. Second, unconditional acceptance of others as they are. And third and finally, unconditional acceptance of life on its own terms as opposed to our personal preferences. In these attitudes, Dr. Ellis sees similarities among teachings from the Buddhist, Jewish, Taoist, Christian, and Muslim traditions. Embracing such a spiritual orientation seems to improve everyone's mental and emotional welfare. It not only makes us better, healthier people, it makes us good for one another, kinder and more accommodating of our frailties and foibles, and rather a great deal more compassionate. The twice fallen Sandy was first rejected by her family, and then by the friends in the faith community she came to recognize as a cult. But somehow she remained amazingly and unfailingly kind, warm and receptive. She went into a vibrant career in the arts and embraced all sorts of diverse people that she had been taught were outside the reach of grace, which by its nature is boundless. In our sessions, she was fond of quoting one of her favorite passages from scripture. "For I am convinced that neither death nor life nor angels nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor power, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God. Nor should anything try to separate us from love itself," she concluded. "Love divine, love amongst us." And I agreed. So of course, Sandy could not let a broken angel be cast away ahead of a holiday. And she intuited that I would appreciate the emotional logic behind that. Sandy's was not an impulse purchase or a trifling gift. Instead, it gave witness to her wise life orientation, one that Dr. Ellis would consider supremely rational. We live in such a polarized time in this nation, a time of emotional extremes, when far too many people are convinced of one another's villainy, when it is awful each time our side does not prevail, when we never really question whether our own attitudes might be damaging to the good of the whole, and when we neglect to manage our individual upset and own how we let larger realities affect our lives. We have come to consider our various truths as absolutes, and we regard these truths as mutually exclusive instead of mutually informing. It's harder and harder for us to tolerate complexity, and we are no longer even really that inclined to try. We have all kinds of cults we could join, secular and sectarian alike. These days, I am grateful for the brave and, dare I say, reasonable few who reach across our lines of deepest division and somehow stay centered in their own values at the same time. No matter how fragmented our world gets, the late Reverend Dr. Philip Hewitt reminded us, we always have the option to seek wholeness. I am no longer Sandy's therapist. I haven't been for years, but I think of her often and wish her well and recall her each time I see that angel on my bookshelf at home. Over the years and in the course of moving various offices and houses, I learned how to tie that snapped string from the angel around its loose halo so the two would not be separated and nothing would get lost. Every once in a while, when I see the angel's halo coming off kilter, I weave in the end of the string just a little tighter. That angel Sandy gave me will never fly. It will never hang from the tree in an ornamental way. That angel is a remarkably humble and honest one. It only stands there on the shelf, steady and grounded, its wings unfurled in a defiant embrace of all that is as it is, showing me a simple posture that is both emotionally intelligent and spiritually mature, gesturing that such openness can be mine to assume as well, at any time, certainly, but most advisedly, now.